the queen said, rather surprised. She's a lovely child. When we saw her last night, she was sleeping like an angel. Sally, Olivia had been a peace offering to Kathy's family that hadn't worked. It was the name of her grandmother. Is a little angel asleep, but when she wakes up, she's more like a little tornado. And she's very good at breaking things. Especially valuable things. What a dreadful thing to say. Her Majesty feigned shock. That lovely little girl. The police told us that she broke hearts throughout Scotland Yard last evening. I fear you exaggerate, Sir John. Yes, ma'am. There was no arguing with the Queen. Chapter 3 Flowers and Families. Wilson had been mistaken in his assessment. The escape had taken longer than anyone at the Yard had thought. 600 miles away, a Sabena flight was landing outside of Cork. The passenger, in seat 23D of the Boeing 737, was entirely unremarkable. His sandy hair was cut medium close, and he was dressed like a middle-level executive in a neat but rumpled suit that gave the entirely accurate impression of a man who'd spent a long day on the job and gotten too little sleep before catching a flight home. An experienced traveler, to be sure, with one carry-on flight bag. If asked, he could have given a convincing discourse on the wholesale fish business in the accent of southwestern Ireland. He could change accents as easily as most men changed shirts. A useful skill, since TV news crews had made the patois of his native Belfast recognizable the world over. He read the London Times on the flight, and the topic of discussion in his seat row, as with the rest of the aircraft, was the story which covered the front page. "A terrible thing it is," he'd agreed with the man in 23E, a Belgian dealer in machine tools who could not have known how an event might be terrible in more than one way. All the months of planning, the painstakingly gathered intelligence, the rehearsals carried out right under the Brit noses, the three escape routes, the radio men, all for nothing because of this bloody meddler. He examined the photo on the front page. "Who are you, Yank?" he wondered. "John Patrick Ryan. Historian. A bloody academic. Ex-marine. Trust a damn bootneck to stick his nose where it doesn't belong. John Patrick Ryan. You're a bloody Catholic, aren't you? Well, Johnny nearly put paid on your account. Too bad about Johnny. Good man Johnny was. Dependable. Loved his guns. And true to the cause." The plane finally came to a stop at the jetway. Forward, the stewardess opened the door, and the passengers rose to get their bags from the overhead stowage. He got his and joined the slow movement forward. He tried to be philosophical about it. In his years as a player, he'd seen operations go awry for the most ridiculous of reasons. But this op was so important. So much planning. He shook his head as he tucked the paper under his arm. "We'll just have to try again, that's all. We can afford to be patient." One failure, he told himself, didn't matter in the great scheme of things. The other side had been lucky this time. We only have to be lucky once. The men in the H-blocks weren't going anywhere. "What about Sean? A mistake to have taken him along. He'd helped plan the operation from the beginning. Sean knows a great deal about the organization." He set that worry aside as he stepped off the aircraft. "Sean would never talk. Not Sean. Not with his girl in her grave these past 5 years. From a Perez stray bullet." He wasn't met, of course. The other men who had been part of the operation were already back, their equipment left behind in rubbish bins, wiped clean of fingerprints. Only he had the risk of exposure, but he was sure that this Ryan fellow hadn't got a good look at his face. He thought back again, to be sure. No. The look of surprise on his face, the look of pain he'd seen there. The American couldn't have gotten much of a look. If he had, An identikit composite picture would be in the press already, complete with the moppy wig and fake glasses. He walked out of the terminal building to the parking lot, his travel bag slung over his shoulder, searching in his pocket for the keys that had set off the airport metal detector in Brussels. What a laugh that was! He smiled for the first time in nearly a day. It was a clear, sunny day. Another glorious Irish fall it was. He drove his year-old BMW, a man with a business cover had to have a full disguise after all, down the road to the safe house. He was already planning two more operations. Both would require a lot of time, but time was the one thing he had in unlimited quantity. It was easy enough to tell when it was time for another pain medication. Ryan was unconsciously flexing his left hand at the far end of the cast. It didn't reduce the pain, but did seem to move it about somewhat as the muscles and tendons changed place slightly. It bothered his concentration, however much he tried to shut it out. Jack remembered all the TV shows in which the detective or otherwise employed hero took a round in the shoulder, but recovered fully in time for the last commercial. The human shoulder, his at any rate, was a solid collection of bones that one bullet, all too easily broke. As the time for another medication approached, it seemed that he could feel every jagged edge of every broken bone grating against its neighbor as he breathed, and even the gentle tapping of his right-hand fingers on the keyboard seemed to ripple across his body to the focus of his pain until he had to stop and watch the wall clock. For the first time, he wanted Kittywake to appear with his next installment of Chemical Bliss. Until he remembered his fear. The pain of his back injury had made his first week at Bethesda a living hell. He knew that his present injury paled by comparison, but the body does not remember pain, and the shoulder was here and now. He forced himself to remember that pain medications had made his back problem almost tolerable, except that the doctors had gotten just a little too generous with his dosages. More than the pain, Ryan dreaded withdrawal from morphine sulfate. That had lasted a week, the wanting that seemed to draw his entire body into some vast empty place, some place where his innermost self found itself entirely alone and needing. Ryan shook his head. The pain rippled through his left arm and shoulder, and he forced himself to welcome it. I'm not going to go through that again. Never again. The door opened. It wasn't Kittywake. The med was still 14 minutes away. Ryan had noticed a uniform outside the door when it had opened before. Now he was sure. A 30-ish uniformed officer came in with a floral arrangement, and he was followed by another who was similarly loaded. A scarlet and gold ribbon decorated the first, a gift from the Marine Corps, followed by another from the American Embassy. "Quite a few more, sir," one uniformed officer said. "The room isn't all that big. Can you give me the cards and spread these around some? I'm sure there's people around who'd like them. And who wants to live in a jungle?" Within 10 minutes, Ryan had a pile of cards, notes, and telegrams. He found that reading the words of others was better than reading his own when it came to blocking out the ache of his damaged shoulder. Kittywake arrived. She gave the flowers only a fleeting glance before administering Ryan's medication and hustled out with scarcely a word. Ryan learned why 5 minutes later. His next visitor was the Prince of Wales. Wilson snapped to his feet again, and Jack wondered if the kid's knees were tiring of this. The med was already working. His shoulder was drifting farther away, but along with this came a slight feeling of lightheadedness as from a couple of stiff drinks. Maybe that was part of the reason for what happened next.
"Howdy,"
Jack smiled.
"How are you feeling, sir?"
"Quite well, thank you." The answering smile contained no enthusiasm. The prince looked very tired, his thin face stretched an extra inch or so, with a lingering sadness around the eyes. His shoulders drooped within the conservative gray suit.
"Why don't you sit down, sir?" Ryan invited. "You look as though you had a tougher night than I did."
"Yes. Thank you, Dr. Ryan." He made another attempt to smile. It failed.
And how are you feeling?
Reasonably well, Your Highness.
And how is your wife? Excuse me, how is the princess doing? The prince's words did not come easily, and he had trouble looking up to Ryan from his chair.
We both regret that she could not come with me. She's still somewhat disturbed.
In shock, I believe.
She had a very bad experience.
Brains splattered over her face. I suppose you might call that a bad experience.
I saw.
I understand that neither of you was physically injured, thank God. I presume your child also?
Yes.
All thanks to you, Doctor. Jack tried another one-armed shrug. The gesture didn't hurt so much this time.
Glad to help, sir. I just wish I hadn't got myself shot in the process.
His attempt at levity died on his lips. He'd said the wrong thing in the wrong way. The prince looked at Jack very curiously for a moment, but then his eyes went flat again.
We would all have been killed, except for you, you know.
And on behalf of my family and myself.
Well, thank you.
It's not enough just to say that. His Highness went on, then halted again and struggled to find a few more words.
But it's the best I can manage.
I wasn't able to manage very much yesterday, come to that, he concluded, staring quietly at the foot of the bed. Aha, Ryan thought. The prince stood and turned to leave.
What do I do now?
Sir, why don't you sit down and let's talk this one over for a minute, okay? His Highness turned back. For a moment he looked as though he would say something, but the drawn face changed again and turned away. Your Highness, I really think... No effect.
I can't let him go out of here like this.
Well, if good manners won't work... Jack's voice became sharp. Hold it! The prince turned with a look of great surprise. Sit down, goddammit! Ryan pointed to the chair. At least I have his attention now. I wonder if they can take a knighthood back. By this time the prince flushed a bit. The color gave his face life that it had lacked. He wavered for a moment, then sat with reluctance and resignation. Now, Ryan said heatedly, I think I know what's eating at you, sir. You feel bad because you didn't do a John Wayne number yesterday and handle those gunmen all by yourself, right? The prince didn't nod or make any other voluntary response, but a hurt expression around his eyes answered the question just as surely.
Ah, crap! Ryan snorted.
In the corner, Tony Wilson went pale as a ghost. Ryan didn't blame him. You ought to have better sense. Sir, Ryan added hastily. You've been through the service schools, right? You've qualified as a pilot, parachuted out of airplanes, and even had command of your own ship? He got a nod. Time to step it up. Then you've got no excuse. You damn well ought to have better sense than to think like that. You're not really that dumb, are you?
What exactly do you mean?
A trace of anger, Ryan thought. Good. Use your head. You've been trained to think this sort of thing out, haven't you? Let's critique the exercise. Examine what the tactical situation was yesterday. You were trapped in a stopped car with two or three bad guys outside holding automatic weapons. The car is armor-plated, but you're stuck. What can you do? The way I see it, you had three choices. One, you can just freeze. Just sit there and wet your pants. Hell, that's what most normal people would do, caught by surprise like that. That's probably the normal reaction. But you didn't do that. Two, you can try to get out of the car and do something, right?
Yes, I should have.
Wrong. Ryan shook his head emphatically.
Sorry, sir. But that's not a real good idea. The guy I tackled was waiting for you to do just that. That guy could have put a 9mm slug in your head before you had both feet on the pavement. You look like you're in pretty good shape. You probably move pretty good. But ain't nobody yet been able to outrun a bullet, sir.
That choice might have gotten you killed and the rest of your family along with you. Three? Your last choice. You tough it out and pray the cavalry gets there in time. You know you're close to home. You know there's cops and troops around. So you know that time is on your side if you can survive for a couple of minutes. In the meantime, you try to protect your family as best you can. You get them down on the floor of the car and get over top of them, so the only way the terrorists can get them is to go through you first. And that, my friend, is what you did.
Ryan paused for a moment to let him absorb this.
You did exactly the right thing, damn it!
Ryan leaned forward until his shoulder pulled him back with a gasp. It wasn't all that much of a pain medication.
Jesus, this hurts. Look, sir, you were stuck out in the open, with a lousy set of alternatives. But you used your head and took the best one you had. From where I sit, you could not have done any better than you did. So there is nothing, repeat, nothing for you to feel bad about. And if you don't believe me, ask Wilson. He's a cop.
The prince turned his head. The anti-terrorist branch officer cleared his throat.
Excuse me, Your Royal Highness, but Dr. Ryan is quite correct. We were discussing this problem yesterday, and we reached precisely the same conclusion.
Ryan looked over to the cop. How long did you fellas kick the idea around, Tony?
Perhaps 10 minutes, Wilson answered.
That's 600 seconds, Your Highness. But you had to think and act in what, 5? Maybe 3? Not much time to make a life-and-death decision, is it?
Mister, I'd say you did damn well. All that training you've picked up along the line worked. And if you were evaluating someone else's performance instead of your own, you'd say the same thing, just like Tony and his friends did.
But the press...
Oh, screw the press, Ryan snapped back, wondering if he'd gone too far.
What do reporters know about anything? They don't do anything, for crying out loud. They just report what other people do.
You can fly an airplane. You've jumped out of them. Flying scares the hell out of me. I don't even want to think about jumping out of one.
And commanded a ship. Plus, you ride horses and keep trying to break your neck. And now, finally, you're a father. You got a kid of your own now, right? Isn't that enough to prove to the world that you've got balls? You're not some dumb kid, sir. You're a trained pro. Start acting like one.
Jack could see his mind going over what he'd just been told. His Highness was sitting a little straighter now. The smile that began to form was an austere one, but at least it had some conviction behind it.
I am not accustomed to being addressed so forcefully.
So cut my head off.
Ryan grinned. You looked like you needed a little straightening out. But I had to get your attention first, didn't I? I'm not going to apologize, sir. Instead, why don't you look in that mirror over there? I bet the guy you see now looks better than the one who shaved this morning.
You really believe what you said?
Of course. All you have to do is look at the situation from the outside, sir. The problem you had yesterday was tougher than any exercise I had to face at Quantico, but you gutted it out.
Listen, I'll tell you a story. My first day at Quantico, first day of the officer's course. They line us up and we meet our drill instructor, Gunnery Sergeant Willie King, humongous black guy. We called him Son of Kong. Anyway, he looks us up and down and says, "Girls, I got some good news and I got some bad news. The good news is, if you prove that you're good enough to get through this here course, you ain't got nothing left to prove as long as you live." And he waits for a couple of seconds. "The bad news is, you gotta prove it to me."
"You were top in your class," the prince said. He'd been briefed, too.
"I was third in that one. I tied for first in the basic officer's course later on."
"Yeah, I did okay. That course was a gold-plated son of a bitch. The only easy thing was sleeping. By the time your day was finished, falling asleep was easy enough. But you know, Son of Kong was almost right. If you make it through Quantico, you know you've done something. After that, there was only one more thing left for me to prove. And the Corps didn't have anything to do with that."
Ryan paused for a moment. "Her name is Sally. Anyway,
You and your family are alive, sir.
Okay, I helped. But so did you. And if any reporter expert says different, you still have the Tower of London, right? I remember that stuff in the press about your wife last year. Damn. If anybody'd talked that way about Cathy, I'd have changed his voice for him.
Changed his voice? His Highness asked.
The hard way. Ryan laughed. I guess that's a problem with being important. You can't shoot back. Too bad. People in that business could use some manners, and people in your business are entitled to some privacy, just like the rest of us.
And what of your manners, Sir John?
A real smile now.
Mea maxima culpa, my Lord Prince. You got me there.
Still, we might not be here except for you.
I couldn't just sit there and watch some people get murdered. If situations had been reversed, I'll bet you'd have done the same thing I did.
You really think so?
His Highness was surprised. Sir, are you kidding? Anybody dumb enough to jump out of an airplane is dumb enough to try anything. The prince stood and walked over to the mirror on the wall. Clearly he liked what he saw there. Well, he murmured to the mirror. He turned back to voice his last self-doubt.
And if you had been in my place?
I'd probably just have wet my pants, Ryan replied. But you have an advantage over me, sir. You've thought about this problem for a few years, right? Hell, you practically grew up with it, and you've been through basic training. Royal Marines, too, maybe?
Yes, I have.
Ryan nodded. Okay. So you had your options figured out beforehand, didn't you? They caught you by surprise, sure, but the training shows.
You did all right. Honest.
Sit back down. And maybe Tony can pour us some coffee. Wilson did so, though he was clearly uneasy to be close to the air. The Prince of Wales sipped at his cup while Ryan lit up one of Wilson's cigarettes. His Highness looked on disapprovingly.
That's not good for you, you know, he pointed out.
Ryan just laughed. Your Highness, since I arrived in this country, I nearly got run over by one of those two-story buses. I almost got my head blown off by a damn Maoist. Then I nearly get myself shish kebabbed by one of your redcoats. Ryan waved the cigarette in the air. This is the safest damn thing I've done since I got here.
What a vacation this has turned out to be. You do have a point, the prince admitted. And quite a sense of humor, Dr. Ryan. I guess the Valium, or whatever they're giving me, helps.
And the name's Jack. He held out his hand. The prince took it.
I was able to meet your wife and daughter yesterday. You were unconscious at the time. I gather that your wife is an excellent physician. Your little daughter is quite wonderful.
Thanks.
How do you like being a daddy?
The first time you hold your newborn child.
Yeah, Jack said. Sir, that's what it's all about.
He stopped talking abruptly.
Bingo, Ryan thought. A four-month-old baby.
If they kidnap the prince and princess, well, no government can cave in to terrorism. The politicians and police have to have a contingency plan already set up for this, don't they? They'd take this town apart one brick at a time, but they wouldn't, couldn't negotiate anything. And that was just too bad for the grown-ups. But a little baby. Damn. There's a bargaining chip.
What kind of people would...
Bastards, Ryan whispered to himself. Wilson blanched, but the prince suspected what Jack was thinking about.
Excuse me.
They weren't trying to kill you. Hell, I bet you weren't even the real objective. Ryan nodded slowly. He searched his mind for the data he'd seen on the ULA. There hadn't been much. It hadn't been his area of focus, in any case. A few tidbits of shadowy intelligence reports mixed with a lot of pure conjecture.
They didn't want to kill you at all, I bet.
And when you covered the wife and kid, you burned their plan.
Maybe.
Or maybe you just... Yeah. Maybe you just threw them a curve, and that blew their timing a little bit.
What do you mean? The prince asked.
Goddamn medications slow your brain down, Ryan said mainly to himself. Have the police told you what the terrorists were up to? His Highness sat upright in the chair.
I can't.
You don't have to, Ryan cut him off. Did they tell you that what you did definitely, definitely saved all of you?
No, but...
Tony? They told me you were a very clever chap, Jack, Wilson said. I'm afraid I can't comment further. Your Royal Highness, Dr. Ryan may be correct in his assessment.
What assessment?
The prince was puzzled. Ryan explained. It only took a few minutes.
How did you arrive at this conclusion, Jack?
Ryan's mind was still churning through the hypothesis.
Sir, I'm an historian. My business is figuring things out. Before that, I was a stockbroker, doing essentially the same thing. It's not all that hard when you think about it. You look for apparent inconsistencies, and then you try to figure out why they're not really inconsistent. He concluded, It's all speculation on my part, but I'm willing to bet that Tony's colleagues are pursuing it.
Wilson didn't say anything. He cleared his throat, which was answer enough.
The prince looked deep into his coffee cup. His face was that of a man who had recovered from fear and shame. Now he contemplated cold anger at what might have been.
Well, they've had their chance, haven't they?
Yes, sir. I imagine if they ever try again, it'll be a lot harder. Right, Tony?
I seriously doubt that they will ever try again, Wilson replied. We should develop some rather good intelligence from this incident. The ULA have stepped over an invisible line. Politically, success might have enhanced their position, but they didn't succeed, did they? This will harm them, harm their popular support. Some people who know them will now consider talking. Not to us, you understand, but some of what they say will get to us in due course. They were outcasts before. They will be outcasts even more now.
Will they learn from this? Ryan wondered. If so, what will they have learned? There's a question. Jack knew that it had only two possible answers, and that those answers were diametrically opposed. He made a mental note. He'd follow up on this when he got home. It wasn't a merely academic exercise now. He had a bullet hole in his shoulder to prove that. The prince rose to his feet.
You must excuse me, Jack. I'm afraid I have rather a full day ahead.
Going back out, eh?
If I hide, they've won.
I understand that fact better now than when I came in here. And I have something else to thank you for. You would have figured it out sooner or later. Better it should be sooner, don't you think?
We must see more of each other.
I'd like that, sir. Afraid I'm stuck here for a while, though.
We are traveling out of the country soon, the day after tomorrow. It's a state visit to New Zealand and the Solomon Islands. You may be gone before we get back.
Is your wife up to it, Your Highness?
I think so. A change of scenery, the doctor said, is just the ticket. She had a very bad experience yesterday, but...
He smiled.
I think it was harder on me than on her.
I'll buy that, Ryan thought. She's young. She'll bounce back. And at least she has something good to remember. Putting your body between your family and the bullets ought to firm up any relationship. Hey, she sure as hell knows you love her, sir.
I do, you know,
the prince said seriously.
It's the customary reason to get married, sir, Jack replied. Even for us common folk.
You're a most irreverent chap, Jack.
Sorry about that. Ryan grinned. So did the prince.
No, you're not.
His Highness extended his hand.
Thank you, Sir John, for many things.
Ryan watched him leave with a brisk step and a straight back.
Tony?
You know the difference between him and me? I can say that I used to be a Marine, and that's good enough. But that poor guy's got to prove it every damn day, to everybody he meets. I guess that's what you have to do when you're in the public eye all the time. Jack shook his head. There's no way in hell they could pay me enough to take his job. He's born to it, Wilson said. Ryan thought about that. That's one difference between your country and mine. You think people are born to something. We know that they have to grow into it. It's not the same thing, Tony. Well, you're part of it now, Jack.
I think I should go. David Ashley looked at the telex in his hand. The disturbing thing was that he'd been requested by name. The PIRA knew who he was, and they knew that he was the security service executive on the case. How the hell did they know that?
I agree, James Owens said. If they're this anxious to talk with us, they might be anxious enough to tell us something useful. Of course, there is an element of risk. You could take someone with you.
Ashley thought about that one. There was always the chance that he'd be kidnapped, but the strange thing about the PIRA was that they did have a code of conduct. Within their own definitions, they were honorable. They assassinated their targets without remorse, but they wouldn't deal in drugs. Their bombs would kill children, but they'd never kidnapped one. Ashley shook his head.
No. People from the service have met with them before, and there's never been a problem.
I'll go alone. He turned for the door.
Daddy!
Sally ran into the room and stopped cold at the side of the bed as she tried to figure a way to climb high enough to kiss her father. She grabbed the side rails and set one foot on the bed frame as if it were the monkey bars at her nursery school and sprang upward. Her diminutive frame bent over the edge of the mattress as she scrambled for a new foothold, and Ryan pulled her up.
Hi, Daddy.
Sally kissed him on the cheek.
And how are you today?
Fine.
What's that, Daddy?
She pointed.
It's called a cast, Kathy Ryan answered. I thought you had to go to the bathroom.
Okay. Sally jumped back off the bed.
I think it's in there, Jack said, but I'm not sure.
I thought so, Kathy said after surveying Jack's attachment to the bed.
Okay, come on, Sally.
A man had entered behind his family, Ryan saw. Late 20s, very athletic, and nicely dressed, of course. He was also rather good-looking, Jack reflected.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ryan, he said. I'm William Greville.
Jack made a guess.
What regiment?
22nd, sir.
Special Air Service? Greville nodded, a proud but restrained smile on his lips.
When you care enough to send the very best, Jack muttered.
Just you?
And a driver, Sergeant Michelson, a policeman from the Diplomatic Protection Group.
Why you and not another cop?
I understand your wife wishes to see a bit of the countryside.
My father is something of an authority on various castles, and Her Majesty thought that your wife might wish to have an, escort familiar with the sights.
Father has dragged me through nearly every old house in England, you see.
Escort is the right word. Ryan thought, remembering what the Special Air Service really was. The only association they had with airplanes was jumping out of them, or blowing them up. Greville went on.
I am also directed by my colonel to extend an invitation to our regimental mess.
Ryan gestured at his suspended arm. Thanks, but that might have to wait a while.
We understand. No matter, sir. Whenever you have the chance, we'd be delighted to have you in for dinner. We wanted to extend the invitation before the bootnecks, you see.
Greville grinned.
What you did was more our sort of op, after all. Well, I had to extend the invitation. You want to see your family, not me.
Take good care of them. Lieutenant?
Captain,
Greville corrected. We will do that, sir. Ryan watched the young officer leave as Kathy and Sally emerged from the bathroom.
What do you think of him?
Kathy asked. "His daddy's a count, Daddy," Sally announced. "He's nice."
"What?"
"His father's Viscount something or other," his wife explained as she walked over. "You look a lot better."
"So do you, babe."
Jack craned his neck up to meet his wife's kiss. "Jack, you've been smoking." Even before they'd gotten married, Kathy had bullied him into stopping. Her damned sense of smell, Jack thought.
"Be nice. I've had a hard day."
"Wimp," she observed disgustedly. Ryan looked up at the ceiling. "To the whole world, I'm a hero. But I smoke a couple of cigarettes, and to Kathy, that makes me a wimp." He concluded that the world was not exactly overrun with justice.
"Give me a break, babe.
Where'd you get them?" "I have a cop babysitting me in here. He had to go someplace a few minutes ago." Kathy looked around for the offending cigarette pack so that she could squash it. Jack had it stashed under his pillow. Kathy Ryan sat down. Sally climbed into her lap.
"How do you feel?"
"I know it's there, but I can live with it."
"How do you make out last night?"
"You know where we are now, right?"
"I heard."
"It's like being Cinderella."
Caroline Muller Ryan, M.D., grinned.
John Patrick Ryan, Ph.D., wiggled the fingers of his left hand.
"I guess I'm the one who turned into the pumpkin. I guess you're going to make the trips we planned."
"Good. Sure you don't mind?"
"Half the reason for the vacation was to get you away from hospitals, Kathy, remember? No sense taking all the film home unused, is it?"
"It'd be a lot more fun with you."
Jack nodded. He'd looked forward to seeing the castles on the list, too. Like many Americans, Ryan could not have abided the English class system, but that didn't stop him from being fascinated with its trappings. Or something like that, he thought. His knighthood, he knew, might change that perspective if he allowed himself to dwell on it.
"Look on the bright side, babe. You've got a guide who can tell you everything you ever wanted to know about Lord Jones's castle on the coast of whatever. You'll have plenty of time for it, too."
"Yeah," she said. "The police said we'd be staying over a while longer than we planned. I'll have to talk to Professor Lewandowski about that."
She shrugged. "They'll understand."
"How do you like the new place? Better than the hotel?"
"You're going to have to see. No, you'll have to experience it." She laughed. "I think hospitality is the national sport over here. They must teach it in the schools and have quarterly exams. And guess who we're having dinner with tonight?"
"I don't have to guess."
"Jack, they're so nice."
"I noticed. Looks like you're really getting the VIP treatment."
"What's the special air service? He's some kind of pilot?"
"Something like that," Jack said diffidently. Kathy might feel uncomfortable sitting next to a man who had to be carrying a gun,
and was trained to use it with as little compunction as a wolf might use his teeth.
"You're not asking how I feel."
"I got hold of your chart on the way in," Kathy explained.
"And?"
"You're doing okay, Jack. I see you can move your fingers. I was worried about that."
"How come?"
"The brachial plexus. It's a nerve junction inside your shoulder. The bullet missed it by about an inch and a half. That's why you can move your fingers. The way you were bleeding, I thought the brachial artery was cut, and that runs right next to the nerves. It would have put your arm out of business for good."
"But,"
she smiled, "you lucked out. Just broken bones. They hurt, but they heal."
"Doctors are so wonderfully objective," Ryan told himself. "Even the ones you marry. Next thing, she'll say the pain is good for me."
"Nice thing about pain," Kathy went on. "It tells you the nerves are working."
Jack closed his eyes and shook his head. He opened them when he felt Kathy take his hand.
"Jack, I'm so proud of you."
"Nice to be married to a hero?"
"You've always been a hero to me." Really? She'd never said that before. What was heroic about being an historian? Kathy didn't know the other stuff he did, but that wasn't especially heroic either. Ever since you told Daddy to... Well, you know. Besides, I love you, remember? I seem to recall a reminder of that the other day. Kathy made a face. Better get your mind off that for a while. I know. Ryan made a face of his own. The patient must conserve his energy, or something. Whatever happened to that theory about how a happy attitude speeds recovery? That's what I get for letting you read my journals. Patience, Jack. Nurse Kittywake came in, saw the family, and made a quick exit. I'll try to be patient, Jack said, and looked longingly at the closing door. You turkey, Kathy observed. I know you better than that. She did, Jack knew. He couldn't even make that threat work. Oh, well, that's what you get for loving your wife. Kathy stroked his face. What did you shave with this morning? A rusty nail? Yeah, I need my razor. Maybe my notes, too? I'll bring them over, or have somebody do it. She looked up when Wilson came back in. Tony, this is Kathy, my wife, and Sally, my daughter. Kathy, this is Tony Wilson. He's the cop who's babysitting me. Didn't I see you last night? Kathy never forgot a face. So far as Jack could tell, she never forgot much of anything. Possibly, but we didn't speak. Rather a busy time for all of us. You are well, Lady Ryan? Excuse me? Kathy asked. Lady Ryan? They didn't tell you? Jack chuckled. Tell me what? Jack explained. How do you like being married to a knight?
Does that mean you have to have a horse, Daddy? Sally asked hopefully. Can I ride it?
Is it legal, Jack?
They told me that the Prime Minister and the President would discuss it today.
My God.
Lady Ryan said quietly. After a moment, she started smiling. Stick with me, kid. Jack laughed.
What about the horse, Daddy? Sally insisted.
I don't know yet. We'll see. He yawned. The only practical use Ryan acknowledged for horses was running at tracks, or maybe tax shelters. Well, I already have a sword, he told himself.
I think Daddy needs a nap, Kathy observed. And I have to buy something for dinner tonight.
Oh, God, Ryan groaned. A whole new wardrobe. Kathy grinned.
Whose fault is that, Sir John?
They met at Flanagan's Steakhouse on O'Connell Street in Dublin. It was a well-regarded establishment whose tourist trade occasionally suffered from being too close to a McDonald's. Ashley was nursing a whiskey when the second man joined him. A third and fourth took a booth across the room and watched. Ashley had come alone. This wasn't the first such meeting, and Dublin was recognized, most of the time, as neutral ground. The two men on the other side of the room were to keep a watch for members of the Garda, the Republic's police force.
"Welcome to Dublin, Mr. Ashley," said the representative of the provisional wing of the Irish Republican Army.
"Thank you, Mr. Murphy," the counterintelligence officer answered. "The photograph we have in the file doesn't do you justice." "Young and foolish I was, and very vain. I didn't shave very much then," Murphy explained. He picked up the menu that had been waiting for him. "The beef here is excellent, and the vegetables are always fresh. This place is full of bloody tourists in the summer. Those who don't want French fries, driving prices up as they always do. Thank God they're all back home in America now, leaving so much money behind in this poor country. What information do you have for us?"
"Information?"
"You asked for the meeting, Mr. Murphy," Ashley pointed out. "The purpose of the meeting is to assure you that we had no part in that bloody fiasco yesterday."
"I could have read that in the papers. I did, in fact."
It was felt that a more personal communique was in order, Mr. Ashley.
Why should we believe you? Ashley asked, sipping at his whiskey. Both men kept their voices low and level, though neither man had the slightest doubt as to what they thought of each other.
Because we are not as crazy as that, Murphy replied.
The waiter came, and both men ordered. Ashley chose the wine, a promising Bordeaux. The meal was on his expense account. He was only 40 minutes off the flight from London's Gatwick Airport. The request for a meeting had been made before dawn in a telephone call to the British ambassador in Dublin.
"Is that a fact?" Ashley said after the waiter left, staring into the cold blue eyes across the table.
"The royal family are strictly off-limits. As marvelous a political target as they all are," Murphy smiled. "We've known for some time that an attack on them would be counterproductive."
"Really?"
Ashley pronounced the word as only an Englishman can do it. Murphy flashed angrily at this most elegant of insults.
"Mr. Ashley, we are enemies. I would as soon kill you as have dinner with you.
But even enemies can negotiate, can't they now?
Go on. We had no part of it. You have my word."
"Your word as a Marxist-Leninist?" Ashley inquired with a smile.
"You are very good at provoking people, Mr. Ashley."
Murphy ventured his own smile.
"But not today. I am here on a mission of peace and understanding."
Ashley nearly laughed out loud, but caught himself and grinned into his drink.
"Mr. Murphy, I would not shed a single tear if our lads were to catch up with you. But you are a worthy adversary, I'll say that. And a charming bastard."
"Ah, the English sense of fair play," Murphy reflected. "That's why we'll win eventually, Mr. Ashley."
"No, you won't."
Ashley had seen that look before.
"How can I make you believe me?" Murphy asked reasonably.
"Names and addresses," Ashley answered quietly.
"No, we cannot do that, and you know it. If you wish to establish some sort of quid pro quo, that's how you must go about it."
Murphy sighed.
"Surely you know how we are organized. Do you think we can punch up a bloody computer command and print out our roster? We're not even sure ourselves who they are. Some men, they just drop out. Many come south and simply vanish, more afraid of us than of you they are."
"And with reason," Murphy added. "The one you have alive, Sean Miller, we've never even heard the name."
"And Kevin O'Donnell?"
"Yes, he's probably the leader. He dropped off the earth 4 years ago, as you well know, after... Ah, you know the story as well as I."
"Kevin Joseph O'Donnell," Ashley reminded himself. 34 now. 6 feet, 160 pounds, unmarried. This data was old, and therefore suspect. The all-time Provo champion at own goals. Kevin had been the most ruthless chief of security the Provos had ever had, thrown out after it had been proven that he'd used his power as counterintelligence boss to purge the organization of political elements he disapproved of. What was the figure? 10, 15 solid members that he'd had killed or maimed before the brigade commander'd found him out? The amazing thing, Ashley thought, was that he'd escaped alive at all. But Murphy was wrong on one thing. Ashley didn't know what had finally tipped the brigade that O'Donnell was outlaw.
"I fail to see why you feel the urge to protect him and his group." He knew the reason, but why not prod the man when he had the chance?
"And if we turn grass, what becomes of the organization?" Murphy asked.
"Not my problem, Mr. Murphy, but I do see your point. Still and all, if you want us to believe you..."
"Mr. Ashley, you demonstrate the basis of the entire problem we have, don't you? Had your country ever dealt with Ireland in mutual good faith, surely we would not be here now, would we?"
The intelligence officer reflected on that. It took no more than a couple of seconds, so many times had he examined the historical basis of the Troubles. Some deliberate policy acts mixed with historical accidents. Who could have known that the onset of the crisis that erupted into World War I would prevent a solution to the issue of home or Rome rule, that the Conservative Party of the time would use this issue as a hammer that would eventually crush the Liberal Party? And who was there to blame now? They were all dead and forgotten, except by hardcore academics who knew that their studies mattered for nothing. It was far too late for that. Is there a way out of this bloody quagmire? He wondered. Ashley shook his head. That was not his brief. That was something for politicians. The same sort, he reminded himself, who'd built the Troubles, one small brick at a time. I'll tell you this much, Mr. Ashley. The waiter showed up with dinner. It was amazing how quick the service was here. The waiter uncorked the wine with a flourish, allowing Ashley to smell the cork and sample a splash in his glass. The Englishman was surprised at the quality of the restaurant's cellar. "This much, you will tell me?" Ashley said after the waiter left. "They get very good information. So good, you would not believe it. And their information comes from your side of the Irish Sea, Mr. Ashley. We don't know who, and we don't know how. The lad who found out died 4 years ago, you see." Murphy sampled the broccoli. "There, I told you the vegetables were fresh." 4 years. Murphy looked up. You don't know the story, then? That is a surprise, Mr. Ashley. Yes. His name was Mickey Baird. He worked closely with Kevin. He's the lad who... Well, you can guess. He was talking with me over a jar in Derry and said that Kevin had a bloody good new intelligence source. Next day, he was dead. The day after... Kevin managed to escape us by an hour. We haven't seen him since. If we find Kevin again, Mr. Ashley, we'll do your work for you and leave the body for your SAS assassins to collect. Would that be fair enough now? We cannot exactly tout to the enemy, but he's on our list too. And if you manage to find the lad and you don't wish to bring him in yourselves, we'll handle the job for you. Assuming, of course, that you don't interfere with the lads who do the work. Can we agree on that? I'll pass that along, Ashley said. If I could approve it myself, I would. Mr. Murphy, I think we can believe you on this. Thank you, Mr. Ashley. That wasn't so painful, was it? Dinner was excellent.
Chapter 4. Players.
Ryan tried to blink away the blue dots that swirled around his eyes as the television crews set up their own lights. Why the newspaper photographers couldn't wait for the powerful TV lights he didn't know, and didn't bother asking. Everyone was kind enough to ask how he felt, but nothing short of respiratory arrest would have gotten them out of the room. It could have been worse, of course. Dr. Scott had told the news people rather forcefully that his patient needed rest to recover speedily, and Nurse Kittywake was there to glower at the intruders. So press access to Ryan was being limited to no more than the number of people who would fit into his room. This included the TV crew. It was the best sort of bargain Jack could get. The cameramen and sound technicians took up space that would otherwise be occupied by more inquisitorial reporters. The morning papers, Ryan had been through the Times and the Daily Telegraph, had carried reports that Ryan was a former or current employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, something that was technically not true, and that Jack had not expected to become public in any case. He found himself remembering what the people at Langley said about leaks, and how pleased they'd been with his offhand invention of the canary trap. A pity they couldn't use it in my case, Ryan told himself wryly. I really need this complication to my life, don't I? For crying out loud, I turned their offer down. Sort of. Already here, the lighting technician said. A moment later, he proved this was true by turning on the three Klieg lights that brought tears to Jack's squinted eyes. "They are awfully bright, aren't they?" a reporter sympathized, while the still photographers continued to snap and whir away with their strobe-equipped Nikons.
"You might say that," Jack replied. A two-headed mic was clipped to his robe.
"Say something, will you?" the sound man asked.
"And how are you enjoying your first trip to London, Dr. Ryan?"
"Well, I better not hear any complaints about how American tourists are staying away due to panic over the terrorism problem." Ryan grinned. "You jerk."
"Indeed," the reporter laughed. "Okay?"
The cameraman and sound man pronounced themselves ready. Ryan sipped at his tea and made certain that the ashtray was out of sight. One print journalist shared a joke with a colleague. A TV correspondent from NBC was there, along with the London correspondent of the Washington Post, but all the others were British. Everything would be pooled with the rest of the media, it had been agreed. There just wasn't room here for a proper press conference. The camera started rolling tape. They ran through the usual questions. The camera turned to linger on his arm, hanging from its overhead rack. They'd run that shot with the voiceover of Jack's story on when he was shot, he was sure. Nothing like a little drama, as he'd already been told. He wiggled his fingers for the camera.
"Dr. Ryan, there are reports in the American and British press that you are an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency."
"I read that this morning. It was as much a surprise to me as it was to anyone else." Ryan smiled. "Somebody made a mistake. I'm not good-looking enough to be a spy."
"So you deny that report?" asked the Daily Mirror.
"Correct. It's just not true. I teach history at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. That ought to be easy enough to check out. I just gave an exam last week. You can ask my students." Jack waved his left hand at the camera again.
"The report comes from some highly placed sources," observed the Post.
"If you read a little history, you'll see that highly placed folks have been known to make mistakes. I think that's what happened here. I teach. I write books. I lecture. Okay, I did give a lecture at CIA once, but that was just a repeat of one I delivered at the Naval War College and one other symposium. It wasn't even classified. Maybe that's where the report comes from. Like I said, check it out. My office is in Leahy Hall at the Naval Academy. I think somebody just goofed."
"Somebody goofed, all right."
"I can get you guys a copy of the lecture. It's no big deal."
"How do you like being a public figure now?" one of the Brit TV people asked.
"Thanks for changing the subject."
"I think I can live without it. I'm not a movie star either. Again, not good-looking enough."
"You're far too modest, Dr. Ryan," a female reporter observed.
"Please be careful how you say that. My wife will probably see this."
There was general laughter.
"I suppose I'm good-looking enough for her. That's enough. With all due respect, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be perfectly glad to descend back into obscurity."
"Do you think that likely?"
"That depends on how lucky I am, ma'am. And on whether you folks will let me."
"What do you think we should do with the terrorist, Sean Miller?" the Times asked.
"That's for a judge and jury to decide. You don't need me for that."
"Do you think we should have capital punishment?"
"We have it where I live. For your country, that is a question for your elected representatives. We both live in democracies, don't we? The people you elect are supposed to do what the voters ask them to do. Not that it always works that way, but that's the theory."
"So you support the idea?" the Times persisted.
"In appropriate cases, subject to strict judicial review, yes. Now you're going to ask me about this case, right? It's a moot point. Anyway, I'm no expert on criminal justice. My dad was a cop, but I'm just a historian."
"And what of your perspective as an Irish-American on the Troubles?" the Telegraph wanted to know.
"We have enough problems of our own in America without having to borrow yours."
"So you say we should solve it, then?"
What do you think? Isn't that what problems are for?
Surely you have a suggestion. Most Americans do.
I think